I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE. It's nearly the end of another year for Going Underground, but some say this year marked the end of an era. As NATO nation-backed wars continue to kill, wound, or displace tens of millions, the mask has fallen from not the nature of US hegemonic empire as much as the entire concept of liberalism. Far from liberals or neoliberals being kindly people supporting democracy and freedom, this year has shown the extent they will go to mass murder and annihilate everything that humanity has to offer. One of the scholars around the world that is helping us understand the death of liberalism amidst the changing global order is the macroeconomic strategist Philip Pilkington. He says that something called global liberalism, encompassing failed neoliberal globalization and liberal individualism, is dying. Instead, we're headed for a post-liberal world where everything we know economically, militarily, and socially will change. The author of the new book, The Collapse of Global Liberalism and the Emergence of the Post-Liberal World Order, Philip Pilkington, also hosts the podcast Multipolarity, and he's a senior research fellow at the Hungarian Institute of International Affairs. He joins me from Budapest in Hungary. Philip, thanks so much for coming on. Before we get to the book, but you write about it in the book, actually, all year there's been the genocide, but there has been the SMO into Ukraine from Russia, the proxy war on Russia. Why in the book does it appear to be some kind of singularity or turning point, war with Russia through Ukraine, that may one day be seen as the end of global liberalism?
Well, I don't think it's unusual that major wars rein in major changes. I think this has been the case throughout human history, really. So in that sense, it's not that surprising. But I suppose, especially in the unipolar moment, the kind of post-Cold War moment where America was, you know, hegemonic on the world stage, we came to view wars as pretty contained, right? I mean, probably the largest war, at least Western war that the West was involved in, was Iraq, obviously the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And that was a complete disaster for the Middle East, but Westerners could kind of sit back and say that it didn't affect their lives that much, apart from maybe some fluctuations in the price of oil. And the Ukraine war is completely different. It's completely upended the Western model, the economic model, the geostrategic model, everything. In part, this is because it's pushed Russia into an alliance, effectively, with China. Not quite military, although it might get there, but definitely an economic alliance with China. And that has actually, in turn, proved that you do not really need access to Western markets anymore. The Chinese can pretty much supply what is needed for a modern consumer society. It's also kind of destroyed Europe because of the cutting off of cheap Russian gas to Europe. And I think to the coupling of Russia and China, that's pretty much destroyed the geopolitical strategy of the United States. You might also think of the turbocharging of the rise of the BRICS nations. That has also turned sand in the gears of the kind of American geostrategic picture. And so we're just seeing the world kind of fragment. We're seeing it before our eyes. And I think the Western powers don't actually know what to do with this. And I think that's why you're seeing a lot of fear and a lot of screaming.
I'll get to the definitions in a moment, but that's so interesting that I better ask you about how in your book you even explain liberalism, as it were, on the battlefield in a certain degree of detail. The commodification of militaries. Tell me why you can actually assign the term, a philosophical idea term like liberalism, to the failure of NATO weaponry in the field as Ukraine loses this battle.
Well, there's a few components to this. I think it's really interesting that I'm an economist. I'm not really a military specialist. And actually, prior to the war in 2022, I didn't know that much about weapons technology and about procurement strategies and so on. But when I saw what was happening, after about 6 months, I realized that something really interesting was going on and that something was completely broken about the Western military procurement model. The Western model was effectively premised. I'm talking about the Western model after the end of the Cold War, but even during the Cold War, to some extent, this is true. It was premised on creating the most expensive, highest tech product you possibly could. You might think of, for example, the M1 Abrams tank. The M1 Abrams tank has a jet engine in it. Effectively, it has a jet engine in it, which is a strange thing to do, to put a jet engine in a tank. But it kind of sounds cool and high tech, right? Now, whether it's a good idea or not, I won't give any judgment on. But what I will say is it's very expensive to put a jet engine in a tank. A Russian T-72 doesn't have a jet engine. It's got a diesel engine. To my mind, putting a diesel engine in a tank makes a lot more sense than putting a jet engine in a tank, especially if it's going to be under harsh conditions. But this kind of gives, this example gives insight into the kind of more liberal that way of thinking about military. The liberal way of thinking about military is the liberal way of thinking about everything, which is technological progress or social progress. Everything has to be progress in some sense. And so if you want to win a war, you just engage in the most technologically progressive solution to a problem. But that's not actually how war works. And that's what we're seeing in Ukraine especially, but we've also seen in some of the conflicts in the Middle East, I think between Israel and Iran as well. And what you actually see is that economy matters, is that quantity can often matter over quality, in a sense. And that if you can get cheap weaponry that can destroy expensive weaponry, you can win a war on that basis. You can win a war on that basis because if the war turns into an attrition war, as it has in Ukraine, then it's a resource war. And the war is basically won when one side runs out of stuff, basically. I mean, men as well, potentially, but really runs out of stuff, runs out of tanks, runs out of artillery shells and so on. And we're seeing that problem on the side of the Ukrainian army. They're even short artillery shells. So at the same time that our military planners in NATO countries were trying to figure out how to put a jet engine in a tank, which is kind of a crazy thing to do, they forgot to produce enough artillery shells for a three-year-long, large but not world war scale conflict with Russia. And that just tells you a lot about the Western military doctrine. They also fell behind on drones because the drones seem kind of low tech as well. They fell behind on ballistic missiles as well for slightly different reasons. But the NATO countries now, or whatever they become in the future, are going to have to completely restructure the way that they do military procurement. And they're going to have to give up this technological fetishism. I'm not against technology in any sector, obviously, but you can't do it for its own sake. It's not an artwork. You have to produce something that does what it says it can do.
Yeah, and you, I know Steve Bannon in Trump's first inaugural speech talked about American carnage. You paint in the book a picture of, and I will get to the definition, your definition of liberalism in a moment, but you paint a vision of Western European carnage, as it were, completely dysfunctional capital cities right across Western Europe, only worsening their economic problems as they fight this war with Russia through Ukraine.
Well, the cities themselves were pretty dysfunctional prior to the war. And there's two broad reasons for that. One of them, which I deal with in the book, one of them I don't really deal with in the book. The obvious one I don't deal with, it's the mass migration flows that have occurred since 2015. I don't deal with that just because it's so widely discussed. I think it's pretty well known at this stage. But the other one that's far less discussed is what's called in the West the homelessness problem. And the homelessness problem is a very strange thing because it sounds like it's because people don't have homes. It's because people don't have houses. Now, I'm from Ireland, and when I grew up, there was not really any homeless people in Ireland, or there were very few homeless people in Ireland. And then in the past 10 or 15 years, there's been an explosion of homeless people in Ireland. And I don't think it's because people don't have access to homes. What actually seems to have happened is that in the West broadly, mainly in the 1970s and early 1980s, the psychiatric asylums were closed down and the people were turned down into the streets. And the rationale for this was that new psychiatric medications, antipsychotic medications, supposedly cured very serious mental conditions. But if you walk around a major Western city, especially if you walk around an American city, you see that's not the case. And it's a really tragic thing that's happened. It's not compassionate in any way to throw people with serious psychiatric conditions out onto the streets, but that's what we've done. So the cities have kind of deteriorated due to that. They've become quite chaotic. And then what happened was we, in Europe anyway, America's a slightly different story, but in Europe, we shut off the Russian gas and created a massive inflationary shock. And what this has basically done, that this together with the COVID lockdowns, obviously you did an awful lot of fiscal damage too, it's massively increased the debt of both the national authorities and the local authorities. And now the local authorities don't have money to spend on basic services anymore. The most dramatic example of this is Birmingham in the United Kingdom. Birmingham is the second largest city in the United Kingdom, and it currently does not have reliable rubbish collection. The rubbish collection isn't done properly in Birmingham. There's strikes on, and you know, you can blame it on the strikes, but ultimately I think it's due to the lack of public financing. And so just as during the 70s, during the winter of discontent in Britain, we're seeing rubbish pile up. Now, that's a pretty extreme example, but you can see those kind of problems creeping in across cities in Europe at the moment. And I think mainly it's because they've created a somewhat chaotic environment anyway, and then they've decided to pile a fiscal and economic crisis on top of that.
But isn't the, you talk about the mentally ill, Big Pharma clearly profiting from, that's the subtext, from the medicines being handed out. And clearly on the military level, the arms company is making a lot of money out of this. And isn't this the problem in the book, ironically, that you talk about liberalism, but you've mixed up liberalism with capitalism? I mean, what is liberalism as you define it?
They're very intertwined. I mean, I would define the regime that we live under as liberal capitalism. That definitely raises the question of whether there's such a thing as illiberal capitalism. I think there probably is. It's probably what we call the Chinese model today, actually. That would be, I think, called illiberal capitalism. Liberal capitalism, to my mind, promises that capitalism can solve all your problems. Now, I'm an economist. I actually think markets are a pretty good way of distributing most resources. Not all at all. And I'd be far more open to capital allocation on the part of the state than I think most economists. I think the Chinese model works quite well, for example. But I think the promise of liberal capitalism is that every problem can be solved with capitalism and markets. And yes, you're exactly correct. That is what happened in both these sectors. The reason, the economic reason that we got this techno-fetishism in Western military procurement is because we tried, especially in the United States, to do military procurement by markets. The reason that, as you correctly say, pharmaceutical companies took over our mental health management was because of the same reason. In fact, in Britain, it was Enoch Powell, who was health secretary in the early 1960s, was lobbied via the civil service, via the pharmaceutical companies, who promised that they could solve his problems for him and save the health ministry in Britain lots of money. So no, the two things are two sides of the same coin. I think liberal capitalism is capitalism for itself. You know, it's just capitalism for itself. It can solve all your problems. And I think an illiberal capitalism would be a form of capitalism where capitalism is only deployed in sectors that it produces things for the common good.
Philip Pilkington, I'll stop you there. More from the author of The Collapse of Global Liberalism and the Emergence of the Post-Liberal World Order after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the author of The Collapse of Global Liberalism and the Emergence of the Post-Liberal World Order, Philip Pilkington. Philip, we were talking about liberal capitalism. I don't know whether you think then that liberalism is inherently to do with capitalism or vice versa, because you criticize Marxism as an outcrop of liberalism. The reason I'm asking this is, of course, because most on the global left would say liberalism was always a mask for the deleterious impact of capitalism. They needed Locke, Smith, and all the rest of them, Ricardo and Mill, to cover up the fact that capitalism, to give it some sort of moral value, when of course it was really a production process which impoverished the poor and enriched the elites.
Well, as we were joking about, liberalism and capitalism do work together. Now, you can have illiberal capitalism. Again, I point to China. We have real-world examples of illiberal capitalism.
Well, obviously, China would completely reject that. I mean, we've spoken to important Chinese figures who would say, no, we are communism with with Chinese characteristics. There's a reason they say that. But if you start to create this idea that liberalism is something separate to capitalism, Isn't there a problem there? Because liberalism exists to cloak capitalism with some kind of moral virtue when, of course, as we both know, capitalism leads us to war.
Well, I don't think that liberalism and capitalism are the same thing. So capitalism, you want to define it first, is capitalism market economies? I don't think capitalism is quite market economies. Market economies have existed throughout time. I mean, markets are a pretty natural formation to my mind. You can find them in ancient Greece, for example. In ancient Rome, there'll be markets. What distinguishes capitalism is the accumulation of profit at a very kind of aggressive pace.
Well, it relies on imperialism, doesn't it? It relies on imperialism from the East India Company onwards, exploitation and monopoly control, and the stopping of markets, the prevention of free markets so that there's a monopoly control right to the big seven on this year's stock markets on the New York Stock Exchange. That's what capitalism is, but you have liberalism to cover it up and make out, oh, it is really like your market in your town square.
Western liberal capitalism definitely did develop into imperialism. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I think imperialism is a liberal project. I think it absolutely is. I think that's what that was. And the more extreme forms of liberal capitalism, you know, go along with the liberal order, but liberalism precedes capitalism in the West. There's no doubt about that. You can trace it back. I trace it back to the English Civil War, so-called. It's really a revolution. It's an English revolution. It's miscalled that. A king was killed. A dictator of sorts was put in place. It's a very obvious revolution. I date it back to that. And, you know, the first text on it, really, the first self-consciously liberal text is Locke's Two Treatises on Government. Those political developments did precede capitalism. I mean, capitalism was very, very...
Well, they were there at the birth of capitalism. They were there at the birth of capitalism. I mean, the reason the argument is... The reason this is such an issue, of course, is that many believe, certainly in China, that Marxism, far from being just an add-on to liberalism, as you make out, and I know you come from the conservative tradition, is that it is the way future out of this liberal malaise and out of this... neoliberal capitalist phase completely. I mean, the family. Tell me about how you see liberalism's obvious impact on family relations, which I should say Marx did as well, of course.
So, we just have to define the terms first slightly. So liberalism, to my mind, is about, it's about two things. It's about destroying all hierarchies, in a sense, all arbitrary hierarchies that liberals see as arbitrary hierarchies. And that starts with, you know, killing the king in the English Civil War, for example. The Puritans would then kind of destroy the churches and so on.
That's not liberalism, is it? That's not liberalism that wanted to destroy the hierarchies. That's the people and the power relations and the production relations within society that caused the death of Charles I. Liberalism was the idea to cloak it. It's like a cover, isn't it? To conceal. I mean, basically liberals are just there on the top. It's like a sugar coating on top of it. It's the production modes that change things, not ideas.
Well, I think it's ideas. I think the parliamentarians wanted to overthrow the king and take over the governance of the country. I think it's, you know, these were minor nobles and, you know, proto-bourgeoisie, you might call them. I mean, Marx certainly did in his account of the English Civil War. He recognizes the revolution too, by the way. You know, I definitely think that the intention there was to, you know, what they did to establish an English Republic with a monarchy. But the point, if we want to get to the family, is that there is this tendency to question what they would see as arbitrary hierarchies. And the other thing, it's obviously very explicit in Locke, is to turn all human relations into contractual relations. And some of them, a Marxist would say, and I'd agree with them, are market-based or economic contractual relations. But some of them are contractual relations with the state as well. Liberalism likes to create contractual relations between the people and the state. And that's a lot of what social contract theory is. The problem with that for the family is twofold. Children,
it's a horror movie. It's a horror movie, isn't it? As you explain in the book.
Oh, I think it's an absolutely horrendous system. I think it's serving humanity very badly. But with the family, children just can't enter into contracts. And so they become a real annoyance for liberals. I write about Rousseau in the book. You know, he writes about the family. And Rousseau, of course, abandoned his own children to an orphanage to die. He wasn't a very pleasant man. But he thought that the state should take control over children because they were an annoyance. They were a hindrance on people's freedom. They couldn't sign contracts and so on. And then you marry that with the kind of tendency to question hierarchical structures in the family. And liberalism proves disastrous for the family. And of course, that's what we see in the West. Family structures have completely collapsed in the West.
One doesn't have to go with your liberalism idea to see that obviously capital would say, of course, women should have rights so they can go in the workplace. And I don't know, the child labor element is perhaps an anomaly. But more generally then, how do you see, I mean, I think most people around the world agree with the death of liberalism as you charted in this book. What does come next in terms for Western Europe? Because the rest of the world is, as you say in the book, getting along. It's going this BRICS route, is going its individual routes due to national character and national separate histories. What happens to Western Europe then?
What Western Europe wants, I mean, they have to make a choice. As you say, and I agree with you, the rest of the world is reverting to their civilizational norms. That is clearly happening now. In China, they're re-exploring their Confucian roots and so on. Iran is obviously considers itself, you know, the heirs to the old Persian Empire. The Turks are becoming much more self-consciously Turkish again. All of these, and the Indians, I should say as well, are they have Hindu nationalism.
And the Russians, the Orthodox Church.
As well. And the Russians are reverting to their Orthodox roots as well. So the civilizational elements of the old civilizations are coming back. Those civilizational elements were broken up a century ago, effectively. 1914 is the year to put on it, and everything that's happened since. The world is healing from 100 years of European war. That's exactly what's happening. The issue is that 100 years has pretty much destroyed Europe at various levels. And certainly at a civilizational level, Europe is in complete civilizational crisis. I don't just mean Europe. I mean Europe and other European countries like the United States, Canada, Australia, and so on. They need to make a decision. What do they want to be now? They've been liberal powers at least since 1945. I'd argue maybe going back a little bit further. They've been hyper-liberal powers since the end of the Cold War, and now the liberal system on which the whole thing rested is collapsing. What do they want to be? I think there's basically two choices for them. They can either re-civilize. They can re-civilize and go back to the cultural norms that were there for pretty much 2,000 years, maybe longer, if you want to go back to the Greeks and the Romans. Or I think that they're going to start to collapse. I think they've already started to collapse. A society can't live in the way that the West is currently living.
So what happens to the corporations? What happens to the corporations that have the real power? Because arguably Western Europe isn't very democratic because it doesn't have a free press. It bans all sorts of social media and newspapers and so on. What happens to the corporations? They just leave for the Global South and for the BRICS nations. Is there going to be a mass evacuation of corporate power and corporate money from Western Europe? And they're just left as museum pieces to fascism, which is one other aspect of your book as regards the end of liberalism.
If Europe can't get access to cheap energy prices and can't put itself on some sort of a competitive footing, then yes, the corporations will, of course, leave. And what Europe will become is what economists call a demand sink. It'll just be a place to dump products. The Chinese will just dump products. And yes, to a large extent, what will it be? A museum of some sort. It's a very scary prospect. I don't want to see it. I'm a European. I'm very proud of European history. I don't like the imperialist stuff. I don't like the liberalist stuff. But I think European civilization itself is very important. And I really hope it gets back on its feet. But right now, it's in complete chaos. It's extremely sad to see. And I'm sitting here in Budapest because it's one of the most stable parts of Europe. It's one of the most self-consciously anti-war and self-consciously pro-European civilization places on the continent.
Just finally, why do you think many scholars in the academy, in all these European NATO nation countries cannot see what you delineate in this book when, I mean, to most of the world, it's clear the problems of neoliberalism and liberalism, as said, some would say, a cover for their versions of capitalism. Why are these scholars blind to it?
I think they're becoming less blind. I think it was very easy to think liberalism worked in the Clinton era. When Clinton's playing a saxophone and Wall Street is booming, it's very easy to say that it's working. Now, a lot of people said it's not going to work. A lot of people on the left and on the right, I'm thinking Pat Buchanan and, you know, the paleoconservatives and stuff. A lot of people on the left and the right, even in the Clinton era, said, this isn't going to work. But I can see why, if you're sitting there in 1997 and everything seems to be going well and Friends is on television and so on.
And you haven't heard about Yugoslavia. And you have no idea what's going on there.
Well, they ignore Yugoslavia and they create a mythology around what's going on, of course. But you can see why they think that, you know, everything's fine. But I think now the whole thing is coming apart. And I think people are looking around looking for explanations. And I think they are going to fall on this explanation that there was something fundamentally wrong with this system. I think people are beginning to wake up to that.
Philip Pilkington, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
And that's it for the penultimate show of this season. The Collapse of Global Liberalism and the Emergence of the Post-Liberal World Order is out now. Our season finale on Monday is with the multi-award-winning scholar Professor John Mersheimer to assess the geopolitical order of 2025 and what we can expect in the new year. But until then, get in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday and Merry Christmas.